You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. We return to the hunt for some of America's most intriguing monsters inhabiting the Palmetto State in the company of our very good friend, David Weatherly. South Carolina is one of the most historic states in the US, and it seems that plenty of strange creatures have also made themselves right at home. David and I dive into one of my favorite cryptid cases, the infamous Bishopville Lizard Man, which hit the headlines in the mid-1980s. Yet the name may conjure up a picture in your mind. But once you hear myself and David discuss the evidence, you may come to the opinion that these people may have been seeing something completely different. We also talk water monsters, as we hear of mermaids that cause all kinds of problems for the residents of one particular town. And we also visit the Lake Murray Monster, before we finish up talking about the terrifying Third Eye Man, a strange creature said to inhabit the tunnels underneath one of the state's most famous universities. But as always, before that, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at Patreon for $4 a month. You can click on the link in the show notes as always, or go to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. Ad-free episodes, early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to everyone that continues to support the show with their Patreon contributions. It really does make a big difference, and thank you once again. As always, you can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and you can subscribe to the mysteriesandmonsters.com. And please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters YouTube channel. You can also find all the information, episodes, and merchandise by going to mysteriesandmonsters.com. As always, thank you to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork week in, week out. The show is produced by the marvellous Brennan Stahl of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So, let's set a course to meet South Carolina's cryptids head on, in the company of David Weatherly. The Palmetto State may offer mild and pleasant weather, alongside some of the US's most beautiful beaches and golf courses, but all is not what it seems. Lurking and hiding around the state are some legendary creatures that reside on land, in the air, and just under the water's surface. Sea serpents, Bigfoot, Simbies, and of course the infamous Lizard Man of Bishopville all call South Carolina home. And who better to be our guide to these creatures than David Weatherly? David, welcome.
Good afternoon, Paul. Always good to speak with you.
And likewise as always, David, you're always extremely kind and gracious, fitting me into your ever-increasingly hectic schedule. So I appreciate your time and your conversation as always.
No worries.
As I was saying before we delve into the interview, South Carolina is a state that I have often stumbled across because of my deep interest in American history and politics. So often people will tend to focus on states such as California and Florida and New York in general. But South Carolina is obviously somewhere that I've often found myself reading about more than perhaps I should. So with its long history, and obviously as an aficionado of golf, though my playing ability varies, David, shall we say the least, South Carolina is a place that I've often spent a lot of time reading about and watching on television. I'm amazed at the amount of strange creatures and legends that seem to inhabit such a small state.
It's very rich in various legends and creatures, as you say. You know, I think part of it is it has some nice diversity. It's kind of geographically in almost a perfect position because it's in the South, but it's sort of in the midpoint. You know, it's just between, of course, North Carolina and Georgia, and, you know, has some coastline. So you get some interesting diversity on a lot of levels, both in its landscape and its people. And of course, you know, its history has part of early America and up through modern times has brought a lot of various cultural influences as well, which also in turn reflect on some of the creatures we find there. You know, South Carolina has a lot of very supernatural type of legends, and not even delving into the ghosts that are found in the state, but just very strange things. As you know, if anyone has seen the cover of Palmetto State Monsters, they'll see a weird figure on the back, and that's a boo hag.
Yes,
which is something that's found uniquely in South Carolina, pretty much. But yeah, a lot of very fascinating legends and cryptids.
It is, I think, especially for one of the eastern states, David, it seems to have this real rich mixture of monsters and the supernatural, which you would more kind of associate with sort of lower central states, perhaps places such as New Orleans and things like that, as you say, with boo hags and some of the supernatural elements that some of these creatures seem to have.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is that many people just aren't aware of some of the diversity found in South Carolina. And, you know, we have the Gullah culture that's found in South Carolina that has had a large influence on some of the supernatural legends and the strange things found there. So I think that it's a state that in many ways is often overlooked, but it's interesting for me as I go through this series, you know, doing each individual state, just how unique each one turns out to be when I really kind of put all the cryptids together, so to speak. You know, it's not something I necessarily thought of. I've certainly traveled, I've spent time in every state, and, you know, I'm aware of the diversity and so forth. But, you know, some people, I think, just maybe subconsciously, inadvertently, just think, okay, well, you know, out west, you know, we've got thunderbirds and, you know, panthers and things like that. And they kind of cluster areas of the country together in a way. But really that does a disservice, because when you look at individual states, while there is some sort of bleed over, you know, you find Bigfoot in pretty much every state, you know, the infamous Black Panthers and things like that. But then there's also very unique stories in each state. And of course, you know, what's more unique in South Carolina than its most famous case, probably the Lizard Man.
Yes. And I think that's one of the states in America that is quite unique in the fact that it has a cryptid that isn't part of the usual pantheon. As you say, most states, perhaps their most famous cryptid is Bigfoot or Thunderbirds, or they may have strange canine creatures and other such things. But here, along with probably West Virginia, we have a state that is really sort of got its own special cryptid, and it's a hell of a case.
Yeah, it is. It is. and actually, you know, that's another point too, though, is that I've been able so far to find a fairly unique cryptid for each state, which, you know, I always try to have on the front cover. So it's interesting to see that diversity too. And, this one is different. I mean, the Lizard Man, you know, it's one of those cases that it's a bit more complex, I think, than a lot of people realize. Mm. And, you know, people who don't really delve into it and look at the details and the facts, they instantly think, oh, it's this giant, you know, bipedal lizard that supposedly terrorized everybody. And people are fixated on the name, which is understandable, because it kind of conjures a lot of visual images, doesn't it? You know, I've seen so much art, really cool art, of people portraying this thing as, you know, a very, very lizard-like, with a long tail and big claws, and you know, sort of like the Spider-Man villain, the lizard, or you know, somewhere in that range. That's the popular portrayal of this creature, but that doesn't really hold water once you start delving into the actual sightings and understand that, yeah, this was the name applied to this creature, but it's not necessarily an accurate portrayal of what people were seeing.
Mm. I have to say, David, when I first heard of the Bishopville Lizardman, it was probably about 15 years ago. I saw a program on Discovery Channel that was talking about the case, and it was more sort of focusing on the incidents involving cars, where cars had been chewed up for some reason, and obviously we'll touch on that in a bit, because obviously that's probably one of those first incidents is the one that sort of starts all this, and then it all kicks off. So I have to say, when I sort of first heard about it, I, as you've just referred to there, had this picture in my head of some kind of bipedal lizard or alligator man or something like that, and kind of was quite, yeah, churlish about the story. I was just like, yeah, this sounds a little bit too far-fetched. And it's only in later years when I've looked at Lyle's work on it because of his fantastic book, and obviously your wonderful section in here kind of brought it all back to me, and I've revisited it all, that it's one of those strange creatures where it's called the Lizard Man, and yet the vast majority of witnesses are describing something that clearly, you may disagree with me here, Damon, is clearly, in my opinion, not a lizard.
No, it's, I don't believe it's a lizard. I've never felt that. You know, just touching on the depictions, the popular depictions, it was interesting with this one when I told my artist, Sam, you know, Sam Sharon, who does yes. the covers, that I was doing South Carolina. I said, you know, obviously the cover is going to be the Lizard Man. And we had sort of a chat back and forth about ideas, and I mostly left it up to him, and his portrayal, which it came out very creepy, of course, you know, he was trying to sort of show something that was maybe lizard-like, or maybe, you know, he had this concept that, you know, what if a Sasquatch had taken an alligator pelt and had this thing on, you know, it would maybe look scaly or partially, you know, strange. So, you know, he sort of skirted those edges, and yeah, you could say it's a lizard man, and you could say, well, you know, what exactly is this thing? But, you know, one thing that I always point out to people who have not been to South Carolina or don't, you know, think about the process of how something like this could have happened. You look at that area in Skateboard Swamp, and if you think about a bipedal creature like Sasquatch living in a swamp, it's going to look very different. And, you know, just because of its environment. And there's some interesting possibilities if you start thinking about, okay, what would happen with a large bipedal beast that is, you know, trudging through sludge and swamp water and everything else on a regular basis? One, he's going to look very foul. I mean, smell very foul. And two, he's going to look very different. You know, he may just appear wet all the time, but what happens when he, you know, when all that gunk and sludge starts to dry out, he's probably going to look distorted in a different way. So, you know, I think that the Lizard Man case, honestly, I think it was a Sasquatch of some kind. Whether it was, you know, some people have suggested, well, perhaps it was a Sasquatch that had some kind of mutation, or was, you know, what did one of these creatures look like if it has mange? I mean, there's so many things that we have to consider that can distort the appearance of one of these creatures, because we don't understand enough about them, that I think we have to make certain allowances and say, well, okay, you know, it seems to stretch the bounds, but maybe not necessarily.
And it's quite odd as well, because there seems to be sort of two or three strands going on here, because as I referred to there, David, my first introduction to this was all these three cars that had all been chewed up. And I remember seeing this program, and they were saying, oh, well, we can prove that it was done with power tools. And I was thinking, and I'm trying to think if it was the first people that reported this, which was the Ways. Their car was parked next to their house, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the greatest of respect, I don't care where you live, David, even if you live in, you know, a busy metropolis like New York, if somebody turns up at your house with a drill and a grinder, and starts going, you know, you're going helter leather on your car, it's going to wake you up. Now, if you're in a sleepy little town like Bishopville, because it's quite a small place, I think this population's 3,000 or 4,000 at most, isn't it? So
it's just a small town, yeah.
You know, with the greatest respect, if somebody starts turning up with power tools in the middle of the night, everybody's going to hear it, not just the people whose cars it were. So I've often felt that that explanation just doesn't make sense. But then again, the official explanation is even as ludicrous, you would suggest.
Yeah, this is, you know, that's a situation where the so-called skeptics stretch the boundaries of reality much more than people who just say, well, look, there's a Bigfoot walking around. You know, oh, well, you know, power, a crew of people with power tools, and they came up next to your house. And it gets kind of ridiculous. You know, I think that the Bishopville case, one of the things that's interesting about it to me is that we sort of have this convergence of different weird things happening all around the same period. And you have to understand first that, you know, this really, this, we're talking about late 1980s for people who aren't familiar with the case. In 1988, when things really kick off with this whole lizard man frenzy. And the thing is that people in that area had talked about a creature living in the swamp for quite some time. It's just that it didn't get, you know, wide scale attention until these reports started coming in. The Way family reported this vandalism to their vehicle. And when the sheriff went and investigated, you know, it turned out to be a very strange thing that was hard to explain. It was very hard to explain because, you know, as you said, there's different considerations as to how this happened or what did it and why in the world these people didn't hear something going on. Because, you know, I even question some of the people say, well, you know, it was probably coyotes or something tearing at the vehicle, trying to get to family had a number of cats and so forth. And, you know, that's a possibility. But at the same time, you have to stop and think, well, why in the world wouldn't they hear that? You know, that's a lot of noise. So we have all these things that kind of converge at the same time. And of course, the report that really kicked this whole thing off was a Christopher Davis encounter, which actually occurred before the Way's report about their vehicle, because it was last week of June in 1988 when this young man, Christopher Davis, he's a young man working at a McDonald's, and, you know, he's on his way home at like 2:30 in the morning or something. And, you know, he has this whole encounter with this creature, and that particular encounter is what a lot of the whole lizard man artistic portrayals come from. But Davis never really says it has, he doesn't really call it a lizard man and talk about it having a long tail and all this kind of thing. You know, he's talked about it having red eyes and seen this figure. And of course it comes after his vehicle. But it's kind of a fascinating account in that there's really no reason for this young fellow to lie. He's by all accounts, he's quite terrified at the encounter. And of course, you know, makes it home and tells his father, who's a very respectable citizen, and decides, you know, well, we need to go down and report this to the police. And all these puzzle pieces, so to speak, start kind of falling together. One of the things that's fascinating about the case is that the sheriff at the time, Liston Truesdale, he took the account seriously, and he decided to investigate them and treat it like, you know, he would any other crime or you know, case that was reported to him. And he took these people at their word, but he was also very cautious and aware that there may be something else at work. So he was, you know, he diligently looked into all the reports and had his deputies follow up on the strange accounts. And he talked to people, and he kind of became a little bit of a celebrity once the mainstream media caught hold of the whole lizard man tale and started talking about it. And he ended up, of course, in various newscasts and so forth, talking about the lizard man case.
It is one of those aspects of this case that I think really does sort of make it stand out, because as you refer to there, the sheriff, when we often get these cases, the authorities tend to try and put as much space between them and the witnesses as possible often, David. And yet,
yeah.
Truesdale's one of those brilliant police officers that says, yeah, something weird's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
These people are clearly frightened. He really did seem to put a lot of value into what people were saying to him and the witness reports and the aspects of this case that really sort of elevated it to something a bit strange. And often, I think that really gives it a lot more credence, because clearly Truesdale thought something strange was going on. Wherever it was, he thought something odd was happening, and he just wanted to get to the bottom of it. And I think it's really interesting, as you say there, that this really seemed to catch fire in the American media as well, because he was on all kinds of programs, breakfast TV, all the big morning shows yeah. coming down there. You know, they had to put special sort of press pits together for them.
Yep.
It's amazing just how much interest there was in this case at the time, because I can't think of anything that sort of exploded in the 80s in regards to cryptid cases, David, that is anything similar. So do you think it was just that period of the 80s where television outlets were hungry for new stories, or was it just that it was such an intriguing and strange story that everybody wanted a piece of it?
Oh, I think it was the perfect storm, so to speak, because when you look at the various elements, first of all, you've got the Christopher Davis encounter, which of course is the one, like I said, that really hit the mainstream news. And it is, you know, it's almost straight out of a horror movie, because the brief elements of the sighting are that, as I said, it's around 2:30 in the morning. Davis is on his way home. So he's driving along this dark, you know, highway, in the middle of the morning. He gets a flat tire. He has to stop and change the tire. And he describes the thing as a red-eyed devil.
Yeah.
That comes running out. It runs across the field. He takes off in his car, and this thing jumps on the car.
Ugh.
So, you know, he's racing down the road and swerving and trying to shake this thing off his vehicle. And, you know, he saw just enough, I think, to really intrigue people, because he mentions the red eyes. Of course, he calls it a devil. And he mentions at one point the black fingernails, you know, of this thing holding on to his car. And of course, it has leapt onto his automobile. So, you know, it's a very frightening encounter for this young man. And there's no indication that he, you know, was trying to pull a hoax or, as I said, he arrived home, he's terrified, and he tells his father about the situation. And they, you know, the father says, we need to report this to the authorities, just, you know, just as a matter of caution in case other people are in danger or anything else. So, you know, you have those elements that come in, but then you combine the fact that 1988, it's this period, it's before social media has kind of taken everything over, obviously. But it is a period when people are interested in unusual things, I think, because you've got various programs that are on air, you know, within those decades, like sightings and unsolved mysteries and all that around that period. So there is some interest in these curious cases. And here's a modern one all of a sudden. You know, it's not Bigfoot footage from the 60s or, you know, vague Loch Ness monster reports. It's something that's happening right then.
Mm.
And, you know, you combine the other perfect element, it being this remote southern town, you know, that up until then, probably few people had heard of. And a sort of perfect character in Truesdale for something like this, because he's, you know, let's face it, he's a good old boy, southern, no nonsense sheriff. And, you know, he's great on camera in that sense. And here he is talking about these reports and trying to get to the bottom of this, these weird cases. So, and then you throw in other various elements, you know, the mauled cars and all these weird things. And it just, I think it was just a perfect combination to grab people's interests. And it certainly did. I mean, news outlets just flooded into Little Bishopville and were anxiously waiting for the next, you know, sighting, the next account of the lizard man.
Absolutely. I mean, it is remarkable that within 3 months you've got Christopher Davis at the local shopping center and they've got a big festival for the lizard man going on, and he's signing autographs and people selling t-shirts on the side of the road, and everybody's, once again, we get loads of people coming in monster hunting David as always.
That's right.
Wondering about. So when you've got the law enforcement having to deal with not only these strange signs, but everything else on top of it, it's remarkable how Truesdale kept his cool, really.
It is. Yeah. And he never diverged, you know. I mean, he kept very balanced about it. He honestly tried to get to the bottom of the accounts, and you know, it was I think he handled it quite well. I really do. And of course he's passed away now, unfortunately. A lot of principals are no longer with us. Of course, Davis himself did not have a very good end. You know, he had some instant celebrity, so to speak, in a time really before, you know, before internet celebrities and things like that. I mean, this young man, you know, unexpectedly found himself just in the center of everybody's attention for a brief time. And he much later got into a situation where he was around some various drug users, and, you know, there's different stories about exactly what happened with him, but he was murdered in, you know, I believe it was, what was it, 2007, no, 2009, I think it was, that he was killed. But, you know, for a time, I mean, you could say lizard mania was kind of all the rage, and, you know, the town sort of jumped on it for a time. There are lizard man t-shirts and hats and all kinds of things for sale. And sadly, they haven't really capitalized on it. You know, I think that's sort of a gold mine, and the, you know, that's just waiting, because they've got something there that's equivalent to the Mothman if they really play their cards right. But you know, no modern lizard man festivals or anything else to celebrate this bizarre case, which is a shame.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those as well that it's very interesting, because I know a lot of people have kind of said that Davis's path kind of went the way it did in life because of all this furore that went off at the time. And he basically became elevated from, as you say, a young lad who was just working at his local McDonald's to instant celebrity. And a lot of people would kind of have suggested, David, I've seen many a strange sort of perception of how Davis was after this, that he literally couldn't cope with life going back to normal. However, I think one of the interesting aspects of this is that all the principal witnesses, because Davis is obviously one of the key sightings, but there are other notable ones, because the thing about this case is just when you think it's gone away again, something happens. And found it very difficult to readjust to life as just being Christopher Davis again, instead of the guy that was attacked by the lizard man.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, some people just don't necessarily deal so well with the whole 15 minutes of fame idea. I guess if that 15 minutes comes and goes, you know, they're just not sure how to return so to speak, to the normal course of their life, or what things would have been like, or, you know, otherwise, had they not seen whatever they saw.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's the dangers of being honest, because if he'd never said anything, then, you know, nobody would have been any the wiser. But, you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing with things like this. And I think also there are some interesting aspects of this, because we had hoaxers turn up, because we have these really obviously fake footprints.
Oh, the ridiculous tracks. There's a lot of other weird things that happened in the midst of this. And, you know, like I said, I think it was kind of a perfect storm in a sense, but I also think that there were so many elements that got introduced that to it's almost impossible to really pull all the threads apart and understand completely what was going on. You know, I do think that, of course, I'm not convinced that some, you know, giant lizard was mauling people's cars for any reason. You know, I think that the coyote explanation maybe is a very good possibility to explain some of the vehicle damage that was reported, because, you know, coyotes will tear at things in order to try to get to their prey, you know, and a pack of coyotes can be pretty vicious. There was weird things that happened. You know, there was, There were, at one point they found a dead coyote and a dead cow, I think, in a field together, which was, that was just so bizarre. You know, there's really no, how do you explain that? You know, what exactly went on here?
Yeah, because wasn't that near one of the cars? Cars that was damaged, because the police said, oh, well, it was the coyote. And then the family were like, well, that fair enough, but what's killed the coyote?
Right, right. And, you know, as I said, you do have genuine sightings of what people are describing essentially as a Sasquatch. You know, they're seeing this Bigfoot near the swamp and along the road and so forth. And some of those accounts are, you know, kind of classic Bigfoot encounters, but they get lumped in with the lizard man stuff because that's what was going on. So, again, just some kind of strange convergence of various things happening. And of course, when you throw in the media and the frenzy and the monster hunters, and then, you know, a hoaxer or two, you've got quite a mess to sort out.
Absolutely. That's before you even mentioned Kenneth Orr throwing his his aura in as well, David, with his...
Yeah, he's a strange character, comes along and, you know, claims that he fought the lizard man, and, you know, he's just kind of wacky. He was carrying a firearm, and it's just, I don't know what his motivation, I guess his motivation was just getting attention or something, but it wasn't even, you know, well thought out, or it wasn't even a well thought out hoax, if that's what he was trying to do.
Yeah, especially when he didn't have a permit for the gun he just left lying about.
Right, laying in the front seat, yeah, and claiming that he has, you know, tissue samples or whatever from Lizard Man, so you know how that's going to hold up.
Yeah, he's a very strange character. Didn't he have fake machine guns mounted on his car as well?
Yeah. Yeah, it was another strange element, that's for sure. And that's what I was saying, is that, you know, there's something about this case that all of these just sort of weird elements got added in and introduced to it. And, you know, who can really explain why? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, the mauled vehicles and the regular, you know, Bigfoot-like sightings and other strange things going on at the time. It was just, what an odd combination.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've also got one of the most ludicrous explanations for Davis's sighting as well, which is there was a guy, was he a farmer, who claimed that he wore a plastic sheet and started running out pretending to be a ghost, but then his version of what happened to Davis doesn't match what Davis said happened to him, and it also doesn't explain what, so he jumped on Davis's car at 40 miles an hour?
you get all these different things, but you know, this sort of happens again. I think it's unique to the period in a sense, because the 1980s, you know, it's like I said, it's pre-internet celebrity, but at the same time, you've got elements that are getting a lot of attention. And I think people saw that and thought, oh, well, I'm part of this. I can get in on this. And, you know, whereas in modern day, they would probably post something online and, you know, mostly be ignored. But in this case, you know, they were jumping up and down and trying to get interviews with the media and saying, well, I know all about this. And you've got hungry reporters looking for the next angle. And, you know, there you go.
Yeah.
Like I said, you get all these just bizarre elements thrown into the mix. And it really, really is overall such a strange case. And sadly, it's one that many people look at it and automatically dismiss it, for instance, because of the tracks, you know, which are ridiculous, you know, these purported three-toed lizard tracks or whatever, which casts were made of. And, you know, anybody that's halfway sharp sees that and says, oh, well, yeah, come on, those are, you know, those are hoax, obviously. And they dismiss the entire thing, which really does it a discredit. But, you know, sort of the knee-jerk skeptic reaction, I think, oh, well, this is fake, so the whole thing's fake. So, you know, move on. I'm not even going to pay attention to it. But you really, you have to delve in and listen and, you know, look at the actual original encounters and reports from people, and you'll understand that, no, there was something very odd going on. Something was active in the area that is still unexplained.
Yeah. Clearly like to scare people on lonely roads as well, because is it the chap called Holloman who's on a bike who decides to stop because I think he wanted a drink of water from the local fountain, and it just jumps straight on his bike and he's off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and sees this large bipedal figure. So there are some very good accounts that turned up in the midst of all of this, and, you know, even the aftermath. I mean, there's still accounts that come occasionally from that area. The Skateboard Swamp, you know, it's not massive, but it's dense enough that there certainly are, you know, some unusual things living back there by all accounts.
Yeah. Because, I mean, even after all this, the Davis flap and everything had calmed down and it seemed to just sort of disappear again. I think then you had the Blythers family and then the Elmore sighting where they were just driving along, and it's their reports for me, David, that kind of made me begin to think that we're dealing with some kind of bipedal hominid rather than some kind of, you know, relic dinosaur that's evolved. Because somebody put that forward saying, oh, well, I think dinosaurs have evolved into giant brainy lizards.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, and those, you know, those accounts, I mean, those are from the early 90s. So, you know, you're a few years past the Davis encounter, and you're looking at people. Of course, again, it got lumped in with the Lizard Man accounts because of the location primarily. But you're looking at reports that clearly are describing a Sasquatch-like creature that's, you know, seen along the highways and so forth. And, you know, even moving forward from that, I mean, there's a report in 2008. So that's, you know, what, 20 years beyond. And it's another car that gets, well, it's a Dodge Caravan van that gets mangled in a way similar to the early cases. So something very strange going on there. That's for sure.
Yeah. It's a fascinating case. And I think it's one of those, like you say, it really deserves more attention, really. I think, as we often see with some of these towns in the US, nobody would have heard of Bishopville at all for any other reason than this strange case. And the fact that strange things are still being reported shows that there's clearly something odd going on around there still to this day.
Yeah, and the, you know, we see this a lot in the U.S., these sort of local or regional nicknames that are thrown on to monsters. And often it somehow connects to the area, you know, sometimes it's named after the town or whatever. And indeed, this one, you often see it has the, quote, Bishopville Lizard Man. But in a way, you know, Lizard Man was an unfortunate choice just because it automatically creates this preconceived idea that, oh, it's a giant bipedal lizard. And, you know, I remember when I was really delving into the case and writing that chapter for the book, thinking about, you know, what would have happened if they hadn't called it, you know, a lizard man? What if it had been the, you know, the Bishopville gorilla or, you know, something like that? I think he would have probably maybe less media attention on it because that's not as fascinating, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, you would have had probably more serious views of the case overall. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is what it is. It's certainly one of the more fascinating accounts here in the States. And just like I said, an unusual convergence of strange things all at the same time.
Yeah. Very true. It would have been better to have been known as the Bishopville Booger, I would suggest.
Yeah, maybe so.
I mean, as we touched on earlier, South Carolina has some weird creatures, and I know there's obviously a lot of Bigfoot reports there, but one of the ones I was really surprised to read about, because I'd never heard of this belief, is Simbies. And also the fact that if you look at that, as we're talking about the creation of an image when you read something, as we're saying about the Bishopville lizard man, David, if you look at the Simbie and how it's supposed to be, you automatically think, well, that sounds like a mermaid. But you've got in the chapter, you kind of differentiate between this belief in Simbies and mermaids, because I was very surprised to see that South Carolina has a real history of mermaid stories and legends as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's of course, a very fascinating mermaid story associated with Charleston.
Yes.
But, yeah, Simbies, you know, there's sometimes, and there's a couple of different spellings of the word, but it's related to African traditions that were brought over during the slavery period. And it essentially is a water spirit. So a Simbi lives in, or some say owns, a certain, you know, pond or lake or stream or waterfall or even a sinkhole. And you've got all of these Africans who were brought over during the slave trade, who brought their traditions with them. And when they did, they started talking about these Simbies who lived in the various water formations in South Carolina. And, you know, they're not seen as something to mess around with. You know, they're often sort of identified with mermaids, but, you know, they're just, I don't know, they're really strange creatures. You know, they can cause a person a lot of problems if someone is disrespecting the water. You know, there's accounts of people seeing these things laying around the water, and a couple of fascinating stories, historical stories, that I found of people reporting seeing these things, you know, laying on a bridge or a plank near the water, and it would just kind of go away and glide into the water. But, you know, they were seen as these figures that were either beneficial or troublesome, depending on what they thought of your actions, more or less, and, you know, whether or not you respected their water.
There's some strange parallels, because it seems like a real mixture of tradition and legend, because there are parts of it that would remind you of the way that perhaps the Fae would act, and also the fact that they've got this malicious tendency to protect their bodies of water, and anybody that disrespects it or treats the environment in a negative way. So there's a lot to these, more than just brushing them off as simple folk tales.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's an interesting combination of sort of an elemental spirit, and it does indeed have similarities with various fae legends and traditions that are found, you know, really around the world. We often just associate the little people with Europe or parts of Europe, but really you can find those types of traditions all over the world. It's just that they, of course, don't call them the same thing, and they identify them slightly different. So when you look at these Simbi legends, yeah, you're very much talking about a water elemental that, as I said, can be beneficial or very dangerous, depending on how you behave, you know, how you interact with the natural world. And, you know, by some accounts, they can be considered guardians, but first and foremost, of course, they're the guardian of that water, you know, that pond or that lake. And that's how they have to be approached. You know, you have to consider, okay, this is their domain. This is their place. And if you're disrespectful, then wow, look out. Yeah, there's all kinds of trouble possibly coming.
Yeah, very true. And I was very surprised, as I touched on, in regards to mermaids, David, because this is something I was quite surprised to read. When you've been doing your research over the years and looking at various states and their legends, Are there many states that have traditions of mermaid stories? Because I'm always interested in them, because obviously that where I live in the Peak District, there is a famous story about a mermaid's pool up on the peaks, which is quite odd for you to find a mermaid in the middle of a national park on top of a mountain, David. But that's what we've got here. And she's very vengeful as well. And often will, if you see her, ironically, around Easter, depending on what mood she's in, she will either grant you your wishes or drag you to your death. So I'm always interested when I see mermaid stories from other parts, and especially from America, because for my shame, I would not consider South Carolina to be a hotbed of mermaid stories. And yet there are two absolute crackers in the book.
Yeah, there are. Honestly, you know, when I wrote the North Carolina book, of course, I grew up in North Carolina and remembered hearing different mermaid stories along the Outer Banks, but they were always very, there just wasn't a whole lot of substance to them. And, you know, you'll see if you read the North Carolina book, there's not a whole lot in there, because to really trace down, you know, I like to go back to the original sources and see, okay, where did this legend come from? Or, you know, unless I can interview someone who says, oh, no, I saw, you know, saw a mermaid. So, you know, there were fewer of those in North Carolina than I expected, quite honestly, because of the nautical history along the Outer Banks and really the entire East Coast of the United States. So we do have some mermaid legends. Now, as an aside, I will mention, I don't know if you remember this or not, but there's a mermaid-like story in the North Carolina book.
Mm.
An entity they call the Siren of the French Broad.
Yes.
The French Broad River, of course, is in the western part of the state. Not where you would expect a mermaid to be necessarily, but yeah, there's one there. And then there's a couple of mermaid legends around Wilmington. But South Carolina, it has a number of stories. And of course, it has this, you know, all of this folklore about these Simbies, which was, you know, clearly brought over early on. But then we've got this crazy mermaid legend in Charleston that just relates to this whole sort of a curse, you know, a whole storm that comes in. And that one goes back, purportedly the story took place in 1867. And like many things, when you really kind of delve in and start looking at a legend like that, you'll see some discrepancies. So there's, you know, there's a few people say that it was earlier or it was later, but one of the earliest versions of the account, it actually appeared in a newspaper, and then it was later printed in a book in the 1940s. But it tells a story about this heavy storm system that moved into Charleston. And again, bear in mind, this is 1867. So this is not, you know, modern in the sense that we think of a modern city, you know, that there's dirt roads and everything else that go through town. And the storms come in, it starts raining, and it continues to rain, and it rains, and it rains. I mean, it's, we're talking about rain like a, you know, like a biblical type of onslaught.
Yeah,
virtually is how people talk about it. And they said that it rained so much that the rats were drowning. Cockroaches were being flooded out from houses, you know, people's homes and businesses were flooding. The streets were mud and water. And it was just a torrential onslaught that was just, you know, you can imagine how terrible it was to deal with. And, you know, people's homes, of course, were flooding, and the rain was coming in from, you know, the roofs and everything else. And the thing kind of peaks when this woman is sort of wandering through town proclaiming that the reason for the rains is that there is a captured mermaid. And this mermaid is purportedly being held in an apothecary. Now, the gentleman who owns the business, his name is Dr. Trott. And he has an apothecary, which for those not familiar with the term, you know, is kind of a, I guess you would say it was the pharmacy of the day. You know, people could go there and get various herbs and cures and so forth. But given the time period, the late 1800s, you know, oddities were starting to become popular. And the story was that Trott had begun collecting oddities that he was getting from sailors and so forth who would come into town.
Mm.
And purportedly, someone had captured a mermaid and brought it to him. And he purchased the mermaid and put it on display in his apothecary. So you can imagine the misery that people are dealing with the, you know, these flooding rains, and suddenly the mob attention, if you will, gets focused on Dr. Trott. And, you know, these mobs surround his business, and they start to try to get inside, and they're barraging the place. And, you know, the authorities try to intervene. They try to stop, you know, this onslaught. And finally, a group of people is chosen. And really the way it's phrased is that they kind of choose both people from the lower classes and the mob and people from the upper classes to form this committee to go inside.
Yeah.
And to see if there is a mermaid in there. So they go inside and they do a thorough search, and they come back out and they said, there's no mermaid inside. And, you know, there's different versions. One says that everybody was still agitated, so the men went in and searched again. They did a thorough search. And they came back out and they announced, our word of honor, there's no mermaid in this building. You can go back to your homes. And when they announced this, the rain stops. And it did, you know, that was the end of the flooding rains. So, of course, in the aftermath of that, different legends sprang up. You know, some people said, oh, well, Trott, you know, he snuck the mermaid out the back door and released her into the ocean, you know, before the mob broke in. Curiously, there's various versions of what this mermaid looked like. You know, some versions say it was, you know, just as we would envision a mermaid, you know, a half woman, half fish that, you know, was human size and was kept in some kind of large case. Others said it was incredibly small. And then of course there's a version that says that it was human size, but it shrank. Because it was restricted and kept away from its natural home. So, you know, getting down to like in the Fiji mermaid range, and
yes,
smaller by some accounts. And whatever the case is, you know, there were these lingering legends that remained about what exactly the mermaid was and what happened to it. But Trott himself, he leaves Charleston after the whole thing and purportedly goes over to Europe somewhere, and the legend remains, so to speak.
It is quite strange because I think, as you say, David, we can think of these stories and we go, well, it's only 150 years ago, and it seems quite surprising that people would have this cast iron belief that the reason their town is being plagued by the storm is because some local person has captured a mermaid. But then again, as you say, you know, we're not talking about the modern era. These are buildings built along dirt roads.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are passing by. People are living hand to mouth a lot of the times, and purely their entire livelihood depends on the weather. And for an area like South Carolina to be besieged by rain for such a prolonged period, it would have been a real difficult time for everybody involved, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. No, you know, no modern conveniences. And as you say, you know, everyone is depending on their trade and their work to survive each day and to have food. And, you know, you can understand, if you think about it in those terms, you can probably understand the desperation that these people started to feel. And, you know, the need to find an explanation for something that was just so far beyond anything they had experienced, that, you know, the perfect explanation comes along. And often in things like that, we see sort of the supernatural element introduced, right? So, you know, in this case, we get something that's very folkloric and, you know, people, of course, are always fascinated with the sea and what might live there. So this is an era when people were, you know, often talking about sea serpents and various other creatures. So the idea that, oh, it's a mermaid that's been captured. And, you know, there was already a rich body of folklore in that part of the country that talked about the idea that mermaids, you know, if they were captured and taken from their home, then they would essentially evoke the elements and, you know, evoke the elements to cause misery until they were freed. And so that's really, you know, what we get in the whole mix with this Charleston mermaid story. And some accounts of it have referred to it as the mermaid riot that occurred, which, that was kind of an amusing title for the event, but, yeah, what a fascinating story, I think.
Yeah, it is a very interesting story. And like you say, there are all kinds of elements to it. So it's when I was reading that, I was really sort of both perplexed and almost intrigued by the whole situation, because it's quite recent, and yet it's a world away when we look back, really. And how quickly something like that can take hold, and people would really believe that you know, the reason it's raining is because this guy's got this mermaid in his back room.
Right. Yeah. Seems rather absurd to us, but, you know, it made sense to them at the time.
Well, who's to say you didn't have it? The storm does seem to break rather conveniently, though.
And that's a very odd element, you know, that occurs. It's like, oh, just when they announce this, it's done.
Yeah. She's free and that's it. We're all okay.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, like you said, who's to say?
Yeah. Well, stranger things have happened, David. Stranger things have happened. I mean, South Carolina also has a well-known lake monster as well. And I was intrigued to look at this because did the reports start sort of after this hydroelectric dam was built at Lake Murray? Because I'm always intrigued because there are a few places in the States where their lake monster stories seem to start after there's been some kind of building work. And it looks like the lake monster of Lake Murray is one of those particular creatures that just suddenly people started reporting weird things from sort of the 1930s onwards.
Yeah, pretty much, because it was that power plant was completed. I think it was 1930, actually, when it was completed. You know, that was a massive dam there that for the time was quite an engineering feat. It's something like 220, 230 feet in height. And it's, you know, it's just this massive structure for the time period. And it's really is after that people start reporting creatures. And, you know, the Lake Murray creature, it's one of those, it's kind of like Lake Norman in North Carolina. It's weird that the accounts start at that point, and there's not a lot of them, but there are enough to make it kind of intriguing and really make you wonder, okay, well, what, you know, maybe there is something going on, but exactly what, it's difficult to say. Of course, the main account with the Lake Murray monster that got everybody's attention was this whole sort of battle that these three people have, you know, where they claim they've seen the thing and that it's about the size of an alligator, but it's definitely not an alligator. And this was 1973.
Mm.
So yeah, these three people, you know, they have this whole encounter, and they claim it's an aggressive creature that tried to climb into their boat, and the one guy beats it off with a paddle. And you know, the aftermath of that, I mean, people are saying, well, you know, what in the world, there is something out there. And of course that calls in other people who claim, well, I've seen something strange, there is a creature or something living in the lake. And then other people who say those three were out drinking or, you know, whatever was going on. There's no monster. But as I said, you know, just enough accounts that we can think, all right, well, you know, maybe there's something. If there is, it's most likely something, I believe, like a sturgeon or a catfish or something, you know, that's a large specimen that people don't see that often and maybe aren't familiar with, that's living there.
Yeah. I mean, often as well, as we know, you only have to look at what goes on in Florida, David, for people just dumping all kinds of animals. And
oh, sure.
You know, it's not within, you know, it's not outside the bounds of credulity that somebody would have dumped a catfish or a sturgeon in there. And obviously, you know, it's prime alligator country as well. It, you know, it could be any kind of creature. I know a lot of people are basically saying, well, these people are just misidentifying an alligator, which I find very hard to believe for anybody that's got experience of being on the water in South Carolina, David. I think they're very aware of what an alligator looks like.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah, I think that's the case. And honestly, you know, sturgeon probably fits the bill the best, just because, especially if you're not familiar with them, they are very prehistoric looking creatures, and they do grow to a very large size. So that's the most likely candidate, quite honestly.
Yeah.
I don't think that the people completely made up the story or, you know, attempted a hoax or anything like that in this case. I think they did see something. Something happened to them, but exactly what it was is rather difficult to say.
Yeah. And I think that the excuse that, oh, well, they were drunk, you would have to worry about anybody that was that drunk to hallucinate in charge of a motorboat, David.
Yeah, right.
Glad I wasn't on the lake that day.
Well, all right, you know, you have to consider too, I mean, if they're that drunk, it's likely that would have been obvious when they got back.
Yes.
And reported the incident, or, you know, they would have been less likely to report it if they were completely drunk, because they'd be like, well, you know, they're going to say I was drunk, I'm not going to report this.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You'd kind of keep that to yourself and just move on, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly.
I was also very surprised, as we touched on in regards to our feelings in regards to what the lizard man really was, that South Carolina has a real history of Bigfoot encounters that often, as we shake our heads when we hear this excuse put forward that Bigfoot is a modern phenomenon and nobody had ever talked about anything like this until the 1950s. Here we have a real encounter that happened towards the end of the 19th century, which has a very intriguing aspect to it of people seeing something stealing their hunting and disappearing. And it's very interesting for me that how it's described and everything. I find it remarkable that often people say, oh, nobody reported things like this. And yet every time, and obviously the more I've read and looked into research and you know, the books that you've done, David, and other Bigfoot researchers around the States and Sasquatch researchers up in Canada, there are hundreds of these stories in old newspapers. They might not call them Bigfoot or Sasquatch, but that's what they're clearly describing, because they're talking about hairy giants stealing food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's that's a particularly fascinating account, I thought. It's actually from, I assume you're talking about the Native American encampment that had the creature stealing the deer that they had taken.
Yes.
That's 1889. And the story is that a hunting party, they're camping along the Tugela River, and they go out hunting for deer. You know, they string their kills up, and the next day when they go out to hunt again, when they come back, the deer has been stolen. And, you know, this starts happening. They know something is stealing their game. So they leave one fellow behind to stand guard, and he sees the creature. And, you know, it's really interesting because, again, this is, you know, 1899. They weren't calling it a Sasquatch or a Bigfoot, but, you know, he describes this thing as being 7 feet tall, covered in hair, and bipedal. And there's a curious phrase that he uses in there. He says the mouth was in the chin, I think is how he raises it.
Yeah.
And I think I think that's sort of an interpretation of, you know, something that really doesn't really have a neck, which a lot of these Bigfoot descriptions, you know, that's what people say is, well, there wasn't really a neck, or there was no neck really visible. So, you know, you think of this head sort of hunched way down on the shoulders.
Mm.
And I think you would get this distorted perception, maybe in this case, of this man seeing the mouth, but just seeing it abnormally low, he thought. So it's a very weird case, very fascinating to find an account like that. It's unfortunately, there's not, you know, a lot more detail or anything to it, but that's an early account. And then, of course, we go right up to, you know, the 1920s, there's a whole series of guerrilla scares in a little town of Easley.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something that frequently turns up in a lot of these news accounts. You know, people describe it as a gorilla, even up into, you know, some states up into the 1940s and sometimes the 50s, you know, they're talking about, oh, there's a gorilla on the loose, because they didn't have the other identifiers. Really, you know, it's again, it's pre-Bigfoot and Sasquatch has a common term. So what do you call this big thing that's, you know, bipedal and covered with hair? Well, closest thing they're going to be aware of is a gorilla.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also one of those stories where, first of all, it's escaped from a local carnival.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's apparently somebody having a laugh. Even though
right.
All these people were saying they'd had their garden fences smashed up and things were tipped over in their gardens and flower beds were ripped up. And then apparently the newspaper said, oh, yeah, it's just this fella having a jolly jape and everybody's fine about it. But there was a mob looking for it in Easley, wasn't
there? Yeah, there was. Yeah. Yeah. We go through the excuses, you know. So first, I'm going to blame the circus, you know, it's an escape animal, you know, escape circus animal, or a carnival train or, you know, whatever. And then, you know, once we move past that and, you know, the menagerie is not blamed anymore, then, you know, we go to the next excuse. Oh, somebody, you know, it's just somebody out just for a laugh, you know, and they've done this. So, you hear bizarre excuses, because it's people trying to come to terms and understand within the framework of what they know, and they're looking for these, you know, the reasoning, they're looking for the explanation. And, of course, now in modern times, we have even more explanation. So a lot of things are thrown into the mix, but during that period, yeah, you got a handful of things that people default to, and escaped gorilla is frequently one of them.
Yeah. It is quite odd, because there's another story, I think in 1938, which has a wonderful encounter from a gentleman called John White, who sees it stood in a pond, I think, and throws a rock at it. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It's like, okay, are you just asking for trouble here, John? What are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah, that was Hill. Another small town. That was Rock Hill.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was 1938. And but what a great reaction, you know, he just throws a rock at this thing. And it, yeah.
And then he's surprised it chases after him. But one of the interesting thing about that is it's one of those first early reports where he describes it having a really foul odor.
Yes, yes.
So it's interesting. But once again, that one's blamed on a monkey trainer. I think that they say he's told us that he hasn't lost any of them, but we don't really believe him.
Yeah, and that one was weird too for a number of reasons. One is, curiously, when the thing chased him, it dropped down on all fours and was running. So it was very ape-like in that sense. But they also ended up linking it to a series of events that had taken place in Alabama and claimed that it was the same creature that had just made its way over to South Carolina. Maybe it was vacationing or something, I guess, because, you know, it shows up for a brief time and then it's gone again. So. I guess they were expecting it back in Alabama, but yeah, no explanation and no, you know, they tried several different things. Oh, it's this or that. And yeah, no answer was ever found.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the other aspect of South Carolina, because there's one story that I'd love to dive in before I let you go. And I know we've not really touched on a lot of Bigfoot ones, but I think there's so many interesting other strange creatures in South Carolina. We can sort of leave Bigfoot and gorillas or whatever they are to one side. And I was very surprised to see a story about a strange hound in South Carolina, David, not because it's a story about a strange hound, but unlike the majority of reports of people coming across strange spectral dogs around the world, the one in South Carolina is supposed to be pure white. It's mm-hmm. That's what makes it strange for me, because often the standard story about people encountering scary dogs or weird dog-like creatures with glowing red eyes is that they're, you know, 99% of the time, these are the black shuck. It's a giant black dog. And yet here we have South Carolina. We've got this ghostly white dog that apparently chases people when it feels like it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the known as the Hound of Goshen. And it's an interesting story. You know, it's one of the reasons that I always, of course, the subtitle of these books, you know, Cryptids and Legends, so that I can get in some things that sort of skirt the edges, you know, that don't exactly go, you know, not necessarily strictly a cryptid, but also not necessarily strictly a ghost. Some things you just don't know, you know, exactly how you classify them. And South Carolina has a number of those. Of course, we have the Boo Hag, you know, it's a very supernatural creature. And yes, we have this hound, the Hound of Goshen, which really sort of starts off like a ghost story, because it talks about a traveling salesman that comes through town, and he's got this white dog that stays with him all the time. And this is, it's definitely in the mid-1800s, like 1850 or something. And so this gentleman, this peddler, he's ends up being accused of a murder that happens in town while he's there. So, you know, has the unfortunate stranger, all the fingers get pointed at him, and mob violence takes over, and they end up hanging this gentleman. So the story was that he had this dog that stayed by his side even unto death. And years later, supposedly this dog is still spotted and has chased people. He, you know, there are physical encounters that people report with this dog, which is why I think it sort of skirts those edges, you know, of, well, is it a ghost, or is it a, you know, is it a spirit, or is it a something that's manifesting physically somehow? And people report just terrifying results from encountering this thing and running from it along this one particular stretch of road that it seems to guard or seems to lurk on.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting, because that's a real strength of these stories, is often these hounds are seen on particular stretches of road or pathways,
mm-hmm.
David. So it kind of plays into that. But like I say, what makes it an interesting story is the fact that it's ghostly white, and yet it still has these flaming red eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting, because I've been to the town. The whole the Hound of Goshen is associated with this little town, Newberry, and I've been there. It's a really cool little town. And, you know, of course, locals will still talk about it. There haven't really been any modern accounts that I've heard. It's one of those local legends things that, you know, a lot of people seem to know, and people claim, oh, well, you know, a friend of a friend saw it and that type of thing. But there are some solid accounts, you know, in the 30s and even in the 1970s. Of people reporting encounters with this thing. So it is a fascinating legend that, you'll pardon the pun, seems to still have life.
Very true. Very true. It's a great story. Even if it is one of those tall tales, David, it's got all the elements of it, you know, wrongful conviction, mob violence, a lynch mob taking justice into its own hands, and a faithful hound that refuses to go and decides to wreak spectral revenge from beyond the grave for whatever reason to the residents and their relatives down the line. Well, I think the last story I want to touch on is a marvellous story. As always, you uncover these really creepy, weird tales, David, in every book. And this one is particularly peculiar, and especially because it seems to be centred around the University of South Carolina, which is not the kind of area you would associate with spooky happenings and strange sightings and weird creatures lurking. But I was very interested to see that it's got networks of tunnels that run underneath it, and there seems to be a few of these places in the area for whatever reason. And along with the fact that the university has the largest Hemingway collection alongside possibly the largest Robbie Burns collection outside of Scotland, which I thought was very interesting as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also on it's a pretty large piece of property. The campus is, what was it, like 360 acres?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, we're not talking about a small little college, and it's in historic Columbia. This is probably my favorite story out of the book, just because it's so bizarre and so weird. You know, there's always, every time I do one of these states, there's always one or two that really stand out to me. And this one is just so, it's so odd. You know, it's just the third eye, man, is what we're talking about. And this story begins really in 1949, when these two university chaps are taking a walk near a historic theater, and they see this weird figure that they said was a man dressed all in silver.
Mm.
And he disappears. He climbs into a manhole cover and pulls it shut behind him and disappears. So one of the fellows was a writer for the university's newspaper, and he writes a little piece about this thing. He calls it the sewer man. And of course, you know, people are kind of interested for a couple of weeks, and then the whole thing just kind of, you know, they move on to something else, and they say, oh, well, you know, it's probably just a, you know, homeless man or so, you know, who knows what it was.
Mm.
But then, you know, we fast forward to that was November of 49. So go to the spring of 1950, less than 6 months later. It's, I think, early April. And there's a police officer who's on patrol on the campus. And he comes across what he says are the remains of some mutilated chickens, which is, you know, not something you expect to find on the campus. I mean, he's probably thinking at the time, you know, for God's sakes, what are these college kids up to now or something, you know. Yes. But he goes to call it in at his car. And when he goes back to where the chickens remains are, he sees a figure that is dressed all in silver. And he says that it's hunched over the chicken carcasses. And of course, you know, as police officer, he brings his flashlight up and puts this person, this thing in the spotlight. And when he does, he says that he saw a human man with a disfigured face with a third eye in the center of the forehead. So, you know, this is where we get this whole third eye man story. And, you know, it gets reported, and then this creates a whole sort of different level of interest. And I should point out at this point that beneath the university are catacombs. You know, Columbia has all these tunnels underneath it, and they link back to different periods in history. Now, the catacombs that are under the university itself, the university will tell you, I've spoken to people at the university who don't like to have this story brought up because they don't want any interest put on it. And yeah, they will deny the whole thing. They say, well, no, those are just maintenance tunnels, and, you know, there's nothing down there and nothing to see here type of thing.
Yeah.
But this story, you know, this story is one of those, this weird third eye man, it seems to just keep popping up every, you know, sort of every decade or two. So in the 1960s, there was another incident where a group of frat boys were down in the catacombs. And at this point, there were various access points for the catacombs. So the story was that some of these frats would go down there and take pledges just as a way to terrorize them or challenge them or whatever, you know, the whole hazing thing. So purportedly this group took some pledges down into these catacombs with some kind of a challenge. And when they went down there, they encountered this figure. Again, they described him as dressed all in silver. They incidentally thought he was crippled.
Mm.
They said that he was moving in a very odd way. But this time he chases them.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, these boys all run screaming. And the story was that one of them got knocked down by this bizarre third eye man and attacked and, you know, took a little bit of damage and nothing fatal or anything, of course. But it wasn't long after that the university blocked all the access points to the catacombs and left only maintenance entrances. And their official party line is that the catacombs are dangerous and that there are, you know, strict repercussions for any university students who try to access them and so forth. And, you know, that there's nothing down there. There's nothing living down there and so forth. But it is, such a bizarre story and just enough to be quite intriguing. And, you know, various elements of, that conjure, you know, what exactly is this? Is this some kind of X-file or, you know, mutation living under there or, you know, who knows what it is? But what a bizarre combination of things, you know, a third eye. Why in the world is he dressed all in silver?
Yeah.
You know, and, yeah, just a strange, strange story.
Yeah. I think the fact that this policeman has the encounter is what gives it real credence, David, because you could dismiss it as tall tales from students. And as we say there, that incident in the 60s, you've got guys going into the tunnels for a dare as part of their pledges, which is, mm-hmm. you know, it's what people of that age do. You know, you try and do things that are supposed to scare you, you know, and to be honest, when I was that age, if somebody told me not to go somewhere, I'd usually go there, David.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Like a red bag to a bull, as I'm sure many people can appreciate. That's the kind of thing you would think, oh, well, definitely then. So it's very interesting that the university seems to really want to distance themselves, because I know you were saying that they've shut the tunnels off for safety reasons now, but clearly some people still find their ways inside it for some reason. And I would imagine whatever is down there or whatever has been going on, it's just one of those intriguing subterranean stories that we occasionally see.
Yeah. And I actually petitioned for permission to go down there. they wouldn't let me. They insist that it's too dangerous. And, you know, I made various offers. I said, well, you know, I take, you know, one of your maintenance people can accompany me, or, you know, but they wouldn't have anything of it. So, they just, you know, they'll try to say on the one hand, well, there's, you know, it's just a made up story. There's nothing to it. And I said, well, that's fine. If that's the case, let me go down there and I'll point out that's, you know, that's the view, that it's fabricated. No, you know, not. Which, and of course, when they, you know, when they don't want that done, that makes it all more intriguing, doesn't it? I guess I'm one of those people that, you know, I'm told, well, you shouldn't go down there. Then it's all the more intriguing to me to go down there, right?
Absolutely.
Exactly what's going on.
Yeah. And obviously, if it's too dangerous, how do they know if they've not been down there?
Well, exactly. Yeah. It's not too dangerous for maintenance people to go. So, you know, if they know what they're doing going down there, then surely they can take someone, you know, walking slightly behind them and going down. But no, they won't have any of it. So,
yeah. An intriguing mystery that unfortunately it sounds like we're not going to get to the bottom of.
Yeah, probably not. Probably not.
Well, David, it's another wonderful collection of stories and legends and witness accounts. Thank you as always for your time. Where can everybody get a hold of a copy of this book and any further publications you've got, and keep an eye on your work online?
Well, of course, the website is eerielights.com. That is eerielights.com. And you'll find all kinds of information on there, some articles and news about upcoming releases and so forth. And there are links to all the books. Of course, you can find everything also on Amazon.com.
Brilliant. And I look forward to your continuing journeys around the States with your upcoming releases. So obviously, as we speak, Utah has just been released. And obviously, I'm halfway through that and thoroughly enjoying it. So I'm looking forward to it. As always, you keep us on our toes, and I'm never even going to try and second guess where we're going to go after Utah, David.
Well, there's more coming. So, pay attention. Watch EerieLights.com. There's also an Eerie Lights Instagram page. And you watch those places and you'll see news on upcoming releases. There are more states coming out this year. So I'm very blessed that everyone seems to be enjoying this Monsters of America series.
Absolutely. One last thing before I let you go, your documentary about the Beast of Bladenborough is available. So if anybody wants to dive into that fabulous legend and strange accounts that went on in that area, where can everybody look for that, David?
Absolutely. There's links for that on EerieLights.com. There's also Scare Network TV, which is where that is hosted. There may be DVDs of it eventually. I know a lot of people just want to stream everything these days. So right now it's just online. But the Scare Network, you can go on and rent it or purchase it if you want. And it is a straight documentary. It's not, you're not going to see me stumbling around in night vision for an hour. You're going to hear me interviewing people, locals, and telling the story and documenting how the whole thing unfolded during that time in a little town of Bladenborough, North Carolina, when they were terrorized by a strange beast that remains unidentified.
Absolutely. It's fantastic. I recommend it highly. And I'll put links to everything in the show notes so people can track these down, David, and keep an eye on your work. Thank you as always. You're always so kind with your time and your conversation. And it's always an absolute pleasure to spend time in your company, David. So thank you as always.
Always great, Paul. You take care.